Southern Storytellers, next on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to the Center's weekly radio magazine about books and ideas. George Garrett is here to talk about his new novel, The King of Babylon Shall Not Come Against You. After that, John Ely will be here with readings and conversation about his book, The Journey of August King. Soundings is made possible by funding from TIAA CREF, providing financial services exclusively for people employed in education and research, offering pension, tax-deferred investment, and insurance products. First on Soundings this week, George Garrett.
Take the assassinations. Take Martin Luther King. Take the Kennedys. Those things could just as well have not happened. About as much cause and effect there as flipping a coin. Bobby Kennedy could just as well have not gone out through the hotel kitchen when he did. It wasn't planned that way. It just happened. Same thing with King. Truth is, at the moment of his murder, he was about as well protected as anyone possibly could be. But he happened to come out just when he did and paused there, and somebody shot and killed him. The Oliver Stone stuff is unacceptable, not just because it's implausible and improbable, though it certainly is both. It's dead wrong because it depends on a pattern that is not there.
George Garrett's new novel is entitled The King of Babylon Shall Not Come Against You. This is a title borrowed from the book of Jeremiah. But although the book is rich in the themes of biblical antiquity, its setting is a small southern town at the time of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. in 1968. The King of Babylon Shall Not Come Against You is by turns a murder mystery, a meditation on the passage of time, and an exploration of the interplay between mass culture and individual lives. With an excerpt from his new novel, here again is George Garrett.
A small gathering of people marching toward the camera, moving up the middle of what seems to be a country highway at the edge of a town, Philadelphia, Mississippi, maybe. Tall telephone poles and light poles march off in the opposite direction toward the flat horizon behind them. A bouquet of black faces, mostly wearing straw hats against the Mississippi summer sun. Mostly black faces. Look very closely in the middle and you will see here and there white faces, hatless. In the front row of the marchers, Ralph Abernathy, Coretta King, MLK, Coors, Floyd McKissick, Stokely Carmichael, and an unidentified young woman close by Carmichael, marching. Marching in this case as a gesture to finish the private march begun by James Meredith and ended when he was wounded by birdshot near Hernando, Mississippi. Marching. How much time was spent by these men, the leaders, marching on foot at the head of crowds to make and prove their points? They, the leaders, have done this so many times before. They know how to do it, what to wear. King and Abernathy look fit, never better. Both wear jaunty straw hats, white short-sleeved polo shirts, creased and clean khaki trousers, each with a slender dark belt, and comfortable walking shoes. Each has a large shiny wristwatch. King wears sunglasses. So does Coretta King, who is holding hands with him. She has her hair up, earrings, a large purse, and a sleeveless tailored summer dress, hemline at the knees. She might be going to church, or anyway some social event, except for the dark sneakers with the white laces. In the front row, only Stokely Carmichael looks different from the others. No hat, wearing a long-sleeved white shirt, bib overalls, and what must be boots, not walking shoes. Carmichael is tall and thin, close-cropped and dark-skinned. He looks to be no kin to any of the others. You can read his expression as mischievous if you want to. In the background, in the crowd, some marchers are carrying large American flags. The flags are upside down in the symbol of distress. Marching, coming forward, coming at you, indefatigable, silent, and implacable. Picking them up and putting them down. Marching.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
George Garrett, welcome back to the National Humanities Center.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be back again.
Tell us what happens in Paradise Springs, Quincy County, Florida, in April of 1968.
Well, the best I can put it together now, a lot is going on at one time. There are two murders, a suicide, a big case of arson, and a disappearance. Everything comes to a head all at one time in that first week in April in 1968. And, meanwhile, things are happening elsewhere on the international and national stage. 1968 was a pretty wild year for that kind of thing, and the impact is being felt by these people, though they are not primarily concerned with national events.
We're talking about the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., for one thing, and then we're talking about this double murder that you just described. But you're dealing with this whole question of what's real and what's the image, what we kind of buy into as a culture. Is that part of your...
It seems to me that, yeah, that's one of the things that concerns the narrator and a lot of people in this this book. They're trying to find out what is the reality behind the image or of the image. And I think in that sense, it reflects our concerns today, too, in the 90s, when so many images are thrown at us,
right,
and we have to come to some kind of terms with them. I tried my best to write this as if the writer, as if I were a Martian who had dropped in on the United States of America in 1994 and never seen any of this before, and to be at once skeptical, distant, and innocent. One other aspect of it was that I had been working for so many years on Elizabethan novels, that three of them, that when I looked up, the world had changed all around me. I'd spent more time in the last decades of the 16th century than I had in my own. And it was quite surprising to see what was happening.
George, do you believe that, is it fair to say that one of the arguments of this book, The King of Babylon Shall Not Come Against You, that the public really does mirror the private, that there is a genuine, if elusive, connection between the one and the many?
Well, no, I think that. I mean, and the book is a kind of paradigm of that fact, that somehow public events, which are removed in space and sometimes in time, in this case the time is identical, April the 4th, 1968, but that somehow these events impact on each other in ways that are not foreseeable and not fully understandable at the time.
Well, let's pause on this for a moment, George Garrett. Do you believe that Martin Luther King Jr. was a hero? Was he merely an image? How does he come to us across the years?
Well, I think there is no denying at this point that he was a hero of the culture, and in some ways a kind of saint, but in the ways of saints who don't ask for sainthood. Who had things he was trying to do, and to do his message, to get his message across, he had to become a figure of images.
Now, does it, let me argue with you, George, does it trivialize the memory of somebody like Dr. King to put his story, so to speak, into the context of a midget preacher and a raincoat lady mystic and a kind of crazy guy who takes pictures, quote-unquote, dirty pictures of women? And again, it's impossible to summarize all that goes on in this book. But
I'd like to think not. I'd like to think that it doesn't trivialize it, nor does it trivialize his story or his accomplishment to humanize himself, that he wore a lot elevator shoes.
Right.
I didn't know that till I read in the biographies.
Right.
That he was a real, throughout his life, from childhood on, that he loved good clothes and looking good, having well-tailored clothes and things. And
his nickname was Tweed.
Tweed, yeah. Tweed. His friends in college called him Tweed because he was the best-dressed guy around. Now, this may trouble some people.
Right.
It actually makes the accomplishment and the heroism, to me, more human and possible.
George, let me ask you to pause on this and present you with an issue. It actually appears on the cover of one of our sort of pop academic magazines called Lingua Franca, and that is the question, who owns the 60s? I mean, that's at once playful, and yet it's very serious. As you revisit this double murder in Paradise Springs and you consider the assassination of Martin Luther King, what is your sense of
that? There is a kind of quarrel about this. I can understand why that would be, because there are the people who were very young at that time.
Right.
Now, I was 40 years old in the 60s, and therefore it was not, in that sense, my decade, but I lived it as fully and closely, particularly since I was teaching in colleges at that time where things happened, as any of the young people. But I saw it with a slightly different angle, sometimes perhaps as more comic. One of my favorite moments was at the University of Virginia, where there was a riot going on the famous lawn, and Edgar Shannon, our wonderful president, had a rich stentorian voice as well, seized the microphone and said, "Don't you realize you're tearing up Mr. Jefferson's 200-year-old lawn? Move that riot around the other side of the rotunda." And they quietly moved around the other side, and when they got there, started rioting again. Yeah. And I thought that's a wonderful symbol.
It goes to the question of sort of cultural authority. And again, who do we believe, and what do we buy into? And one of the issues in this book, for example, might be the nature of what it means to be young and grow a little older and look back and capture the past.
Yes, I hope so. I hope that that is the case. And everybody will have a different experience of the 60s, I'm sure, although many of these will touch each other, touch each other as overlapping. You know, my students in class would have a different view of what was going on than I did, but we're both looking at the same thing. And that may be part of what this book is about, the fragmentary images that we both look at and try to put together in different forms.
George, are you indulging in a kind of nostalgia here as you look back to your fictional town of Paradise Springs in Central Florida in the 60s? And you are a product of Central Florida. Is this a visit personal for you to your home?
It's a visit in memory, because I haven't lived. I still have some family down there, but I haven't lived in Central Florida in many years. So that my recollection of it, that may have given it a kind of nostalgic glow,
right,
in that I am working with memory more than immediate fact. It's not the, I look out of the window and I see the Blue Ridge Mountains in Charlottesville, Virginia. And I don't see the flat world of Florida.
And is the memory a consolation, or is it a burr under the literary creative saddle here, so to speak?
It's a mixed memory, like any others. There are consoling things and there are irritating things.
George Garrett's new novel is entitled The King of Babylon Shall Not Come Against You, published last year by Harcourt Brace. George Garrett's other books include Death of the Fox, The Succession, and Entered from the Sun. In 1989, George Garrett received the T.S. Eliot Award. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Straight ahead, more Southern storytelling. John Ely is here to read from and talk about his novel, The Journey of August King.
When it was dark, this being the third day, August took Sarah's herbs out of doors and scattered them on her grave. He stood in the field for a while, stood alone, waiting for the moon to clear itself of clouds so he could see what would come of the night, if any of the men were to return or not, and so he could say good night to them all, the graves, and to her. "It's a good night for you to travel, Anna," he said to the wind. Move on, little girl, to the north country." He sat down on a rock slab he had but this past spring, with his mares lunging, broke free from the hill, and which he had been meaning ever since to pull on down into the yard. "I tell you, Sarah, it has been an unaccountable day for arguments," he said. "I have felt more strangeness today than on a sad Christmas." He sat there considering that, smiling whimsically, bemused by the notion, and for a while he said nothing more. Then he straightened. "But I tell you," he said to the graves and the wind, "I've never been so proud."
John Ely is the author of 11 books of fiction and 6 books of nonfiction. Among his novels is The Journey of August King, the story of an early 19th century farmer who decides to help a runaway slave girl when their paths cross in the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina. When August King encounters the slave girl Annalise during his annual trading trip, he confronts a personal crisis of belief and courage, but he also embarks upon a journey within himself. With another excerpt from The Journey of August King, here is John Ely.
He was not conscious of danger that afternoon, not in the least, which surprised him. He knew he was in danger, but he suffered no effect of it. He was astonished at himself to find himself walking free and in the clear, walking along this road. August C. King, whatever your name is, whoever you are, walking on this road without fear, transporting her, the object of a far-ranging search. August, I scarcely know you in your greatness, he told himself. Is it not true that God marks us, chooses us? Puts his finger on our forehead, says, you, conjures us. Just as it is true that lightning will strike a tree, not any special tree, not a tree necessarily that stands the highest or is the largest or the oldest in the field. Lightning makes its own secret selection. I'm not free myself, he said, walking along, the idea coming to him all of a sudden. If I'm not free, how can you be free? When was a man free ever? The shape of our face, the health of our hand. All the more important matters tend to be decided for us by birth or accident or God or fate or chance or accident or whatever, or by our parents, our brothers, our sisters, our friends, our lovers, our haters in the day, our haters in the night, our beasts, our brutes, our paths on the hills, our oak tree felled by lightning.
Mr. Ely, give our listeners a sense of what happens in The Journey of August King.
This farmer in the early 1800s is going home. Back then, everybody was a farmer. And some of the rich farmers were called planters. And some planters had slaves, of course, even in the mountains of North Carolina. The planters were not liked very much by the farmers, nor were the slaves, for that matter. The fellow named August King is going home, and when he goes down to a creek to get some water, he finds down there a runaway slave girl, about 16 years old. And he expresses an interest in giving her something to eat anyway, and he would help her if he could, but it's quite much against the law in a place where the law breaking the law is punished by the local people. There were no sheriffs up there or anything. So he goes on to the inn, but that night he worries about it a good deal, and the next morning he takes a couple of loaves of cornbread back there. He's going to feed this girl anyway and tell her how to get to the north, and he does not succeed in finding her that time. He goes on up the trail, and she comes to his camp that night, and he feels that kind of fate has designated him to do something he'd never thought he would ever possibly do, and that's be heroic in any way. Nor had he ever broken the law, to his knowledge.
The $64 question, Mr. Ely, is why does he do it? I mean, here to create a sense of what, fidelity to history, and yet move your readers through a novel, you've got something of a contradiction. I mean, this man's actions are not entirely consistent with the temper of his times, and yet he decides to help a runaway slave. Why does he do that?
It's mostly the fact that he finds himself designated. He finds an opportunity here to come out of a cocoon in which he's been living for most of his life and become somebody extraordinary.
He's also thinking about his wife and his child, both of whom have died, one by illness, the other apparently a suicide. And he's deeply troubled with this relationship that he has with his little daughter and his wife, both of whom are dead. And that, in a way, feeds into the relationship that he has with this runaway slave. Talk to us about that.
Yes, in a way, he's looking for freedom, too. Freedom from a sense of guilt that he didn't do all he might have in these previous encounters. And so she is looking for a way to get to the north, and he is looking for a way to free himself from past guilt association.
Talk to our listeners, Mr. Ely, about a character whose name is Olaf Singletary. Now, here we have a sort of good guy, bad guy, mainly bad guy, but he's not entirely unredeemed as a character. He's the one who owns Annalise, and he's the one who has instigated the search for this runaway slave.
Well, Olaf is one of the richest men in the Saxon. And he offers a Maryland riding horse for the return of Annalise. He also offers some land on the river, some river bottom land.
A human life worth a Virginia horse.
Yeah. Well, that's a pretty high price, actually, for a human being back then. The boy who ran away with her and who sort of disappears from the story until near the end, at which point he's killed, he offers very little for him, although generally a young man would bring as much or more than a young lady in those days.
Why does Olaf care about Annalise? I mean, this is not simply a commodity to him. It's clear in your book that he's passionate about her. There are
Annalise
lots of reasons.
Annalise is bubbly. She's personable. She's likable. She's a sort of person you would like to have around.
She's got some spirit to her.
Yeah, she relieves his day. He is very fond of her.
Uh-huh.
Possibly he's her father. We don't know exactly, but
he
misses her, and he wants her back, and he wants her back unsullied, as he says. He doesn't want anybody fooling around with her.
Let me stop you for a moment, Mr. Ely. Where does this come from? What's the wellspring of your conviction when you translate it, when you speak as a flesh and blood human being, and when you translate it into artistic expression?
I don't know. You're asking a writer something that would be beyond him, just as I don't think August King would be able to say why he was doing what he did.
But surely it's not simply an aesthetic kind of thing. Surely it is not simply the pleasure of the story. I mean, there has to be, does there not, some sort of a foundation in your own personality and character when you write about large and sensitive and difficult issues like runaway slaves in the 19th century and the way we treat each other today in the 20th.
I wouldn't say that that's not true, but I don't know. I really am not able to contribute very much to it. I really don't know why. It's fun, for one thing. I enjoy it.
Mr. Ely, in the course of the journey of August King, we have a profound spiritual transformation that occurs. Do you want that to happen to your readers when they read this book? Is that what you're after?
No, it really isn't. No, I'm just telling a story. I'm not trying to make anybody, I'm not trying to convert anybody to anything. I have written nonfiction books which did, but I've never written a novel which sought to do more than simply tell a story. Now, the story might persuade somebody that he, living the, becoming the character, a character in the book, he might have a transformation of some sort. I certainly think in this case the reader is urged to identify with August King. Now, if you do, you will go through his experiences, and you will come out the end a wounded and proud man.
John Ely is the author of The Journey of August King, published in paperback last year by Hyperion Miramax Books. The Journey of August King is also available on video from Miramax Films. John Ely is a founder of the North Carolina School of the Arts. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings is made possible by TIAA CREF, providing financial services exclusively for people employed in education and research, offering pension, tax-deferred investment, and insurance products. I'll be back in just a moment with information about where to write for a cassette tape of this program. Listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guests this week were writers George Garrett and John Ely. For a cassette tape, call us at 919-549-0661 or send $10 to Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. This week it's program number 856. Our email address is sounding, S-O-U-N-D-I-N-G, at ga.unc.edu. Visit our site on the World Wide Web at www.nhc.rtp.nc.us/8080. Next week on Soundings, Languages Foreign and Domestic. Robert Fradkin of the University of Maryland will be here to talk about his new book, The Well-Tempered Announcer, or How to Take the Foreignness Out of Foreign Languages. Connie Ebley of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill will also be here to discuss her new book, Slang and Sociability, an exploration of how college kids talk and about the interplay among language, identity, and authority. Finally, a program note. A few cabins remain on the National Humanities Center study session to the Greek islands in Turkey aboard the exclusively chartered four-masted yacht Sea Cloud. Information provided, 1-888-650-TOUR. That's 1-888-650-8687. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.